The thing about bubbles is they're only obvious after the fact. Until then, you just never know. But one thing is pretty much certain. Bubbles and bus will happen again. I'm Veronica Rickard, glad to be with you this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, the author of the article, Why Wall Street Always Blows It, which appears in this month's Atlantic Monthly. Our guest for the first part of the morning is Henry Blodgett, a former securities analyst and an editor at the Silicon Valley Insider, an online business publication, and he's also a contributor to Atlantic Monthly. Also joining us this morning, John Carney, also an editor at the Silicon Valley Insider. And we invite you to join us this morning, too. What lessons are you drawing from the recent financial meltdown, and can we do anything differently next time? The number to call this morning is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send us email at talk@wpr.org. And Henry Blodgett, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
You know, a lot of finger-pointing has gone on since the financial meltdown, which, of course, isn't over yet. But you write about it as something that isn't so much a matter of blame as just the fact of accepting a natural process.
I think that's right. I think there are obviously lots of mistakes that have been made, and there are in every time we have a bubble like this, everything's obvious in hindsight, and you look back and you say, okay, why was that regulation loose? Why did we let mortgage policies get so loose? Why did we have a system that just encouraged everyone to keep pumping out mortgages and putting people into houses they can't afford and so forth? And all of those things obviously play a role. But if you step back from it a little bit more and you look at the housing bubble in the context of a lot of the huge financial bubbles we've had over time, what you find is that in a boom like the one we have, regulations always relax and people always want the freedom to make their own decisions and to take on more debt than they can afford and all those things, because those things seem very smart at the time and they seem like positives and society is getting richer as a result. And so over and over again, we see this process where the regulations get relaxed, this happens, there's a tremendous crash with devastating consequences, and then we revisit all the regulations and tighten them all up, and they stay tight for 30 years or so, but then eventually you get another boom, and it all starts all over again.
Is part of this that maybe it's just human nature to sort of, I guess, get into this gold rush mentality where there's something good and everybody wants in on it and nobody wants to be the killjoy who says no?
That's exactly right. If you go back to 2004 and you think about what was happening then with regard to housing, there were a few voices saying, hey, look, houses are overvalued. This is going to end in a bad way. We really should put a stop to this. But they were a minority, and everybody else was saying, now, hey, wait a minute. I have all this home equity that's building up in my house. I'm able to borrow against that and buy great stuff and remodel. And my friend who's a mortgage broker is getting rich, and the banks are doing well, and society is doing incredibly well because all of these people are employed, and rising house prices are good for everybody. So why on earth would we ever want to stop that? And there's nothing that it was going to make house prices go down. And year after year, what would happen is that the voices who were saying, hey, wait a minute, would be proven wrong, seemingly, because house prices kept going up. And gradually, everybody gets sucked into that. And it's very hard at the time to have the perspective and the confidence necessary to sit back and say, everybody is wrong. This is just simply a temporary appreciation in price, and it's going to come crashing down. Those people are few and far between. And at the time, they seem like fools.
Well, you even have some stories in your article about people who were actually a little bit wiser about the whole thing, but their bosses were telling them, no, no, you've got to buy like everybody else.
Well, that's right. You look at the individual incentives who everybody who played a part in this whole thing. You go to the real estate broker who's obviously not charged with preventing people from paying too much for houses. They're hired to sell houses. And you have the mortgage broker who is not his job to decide whether a particular house is a little bit too expensive, but it is to lend money and make another loan. And Wall Street is looking for products to package up into these mortgage-backed securities, which there is seemingly an inexhaustible irresistible appetite for. So they'll keep pushing on that. And again, in hindsight, all of this stuff looks irresponsible, and there's no question that you had predatory lenders putting people into loans that they never should have had, and there was a lot of behavior that should have been monitored at the time. But at the base, you have house prices continuing to go up, and that's creating a lot of good for a lot of people. And so it's very hard to step in and say, we must stop this now, especially when you have experts like Alan Greenspan from the Fed chairmanship saying, no, there isn't a bubble. Perhaps there's a little bit of froth in some areas, but there is no national housing bubble.
Well, whose job is it to protect us, to make sure this doesn't happen again? I mean, you place a portion of the blame, you know, squarely on the average guy and lady who wanted to get in on this, but isn't someone, where does the buck stop?
I think the main point is that the buck really does not stop with anybody. We do live in an economy that's a free market economy. There are a lot of benefits to that. We could choose to live in communism where it's command and control and we could set prices of everything, but we have a lot of history demonstrating that that doesn't particularly work well as an economic system. So we choose to have a free market. Obviously, we should have had more regulation and there should have been a higher hurdle for people to have collateral and have to prove their income to take out loans and a lot of other things. But at the time, of course, that would have produced screams where you'd say, hey, wait a minute, I want to buy a house. I'm responsible. I know I'm going to pay it back. My situation is good. So why won't you let me do that? People would scream at that regulation. But I think, unfortunately, there are individual entities and individuals made mistakes in hindsight, but it's very hard to lay the entire thing at one party's feet because no one other than possibly Alan Greenspan had the control to say, okay, we are going to stop the entire housing market because we know from our perspective it's a bubble, even though so many experts are saying it's not a bubble and so forth. So really with all of these things, there is no one entity that has enough control to stop it.
Well, the middle class is really screaming right now. They're really feeling this financial meltdown. And there are those that say that the system is not set up to protect the middle class right now. And in fact, the middle class and you know, public people in general shouldn't be allowed to invest their own retirement savings, for instance, that it's just not safe. We're not good enough at it.
I think that's a great point, and I think obviously we've had cries for the last 8 years to privatize Social Security and give people control over their own retirement savings, and to your point, investing it wisely is actually incredibly difficult, not because you have to be a financial wizard and go out and pick the right stocks and that sort of thing, but because there's just so much bad investment advice and common sense out there that is not, in fact, sense. It's very common. But it's relatively rare individual who has the time to go through all the academic literature and figure out that the wisest strategy for most individual investors is to allocate your assets very conservatively across a few different asset classes and buy low-cost index funds. That is easy to do once you understand it, but in fact, it's very rare that you find somebody who's done the work necessary to have the confidence to realize that that's the smartest move. So I do think that we're going to have a huge backlash against this idea that every individual should be completely in control of their retirement savings and should be able to invest it however they like. There was a lot to say for having big, smart institutions manage that money. Of course, in many cases, unfortunately, they did a terrible job of managing it as well. But there is a benefit to Social Security. It was put there for a reason, and hopefully one positive thing that will come out of all this is that people will realize that the idea of splitting that up and giving it to all the individuals is probably not the way to go.
Well, we have a lot of folks on the line waiting to talk to you, and since we've only got you for half an hour, let's go to the phones a little bit early now and pick up a call from Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I guess my thing is that I don't know why people are so surprised at what happened here. Fundamentally, the market runs on greed, and you know, we could say, is it controlled greed or uncontrolled greed? Many of the people that have the MBAs and the advanced degrees in economics and so forth, they all bend over at the idol of Adam Smith and his treatise, Wealth of Nations. And from that is a phrase which many people are familiar, which is the invisible hand. And what I think a lot of those people, they like very like many fundamentalists in religion, they read into it what they want to hear. And in this case, they read into the invisible hand being kind of this open, benign, helping hand, when it can just as easily be an iron fist that will knock you down. And mm-hmm. But they tend to ignore that aspect of the market. And one of the things we need to remember, too, is that Adam Smith, when he wrote about the wealth of nations, is that he was fundamentally a political philosopher first. He was not an economist. And his premise, when he talked about the wealth of nations and some of the principles which many of our market policymakers follow today, is he was talking about the moral man, the man that was in the marketplace that had a fundamental basis in the Anglo Protestant type of tradition of moralism. And this is something that quite frankly, is also forgotten. And when we don't have morality coming by acting by individuals, people acting out of morality as individuals, we have to enforce that morality, and enforcing that morality is what we call regulation. And that is something we got to keep in mind, is that if we can't count on people using the fundamental principle of the market, which is greed, but we can't count on them working in a moral way, as we understand a moral to be within our society, then our society has to come in and impose that morality through regulation.
Some great points, Mike. Thank you. Henry Blodgett.
I think those are great points, Mike. I think that the part of the issue is that it definitely at the edges, I think you will, as we dig through the records of the decisions that were made in the bubble, you will definitely find people in a lot of professions that made decisions that were, if not immoral, certainly were not really looking out for the best interests of customers and that sort of thing. I think part of the issue, and it's what I was trying to highlight in the Atlantic article, is that in the center of most of these constituencies, you did have people who were behaving morally, and again, you go back to the real estate agent who sells you the house at the top of the market, you can now point the finger and say, well, wait a minute, you should have known that that house was going to fall in price by 30%. I'm not an expert. You're the expert. How could you sell me that house? On the other hand, I do think it's a little bit unrealistic to ask a real estate agent to not sell houses because they think the market has gotten a little too expensive, when effectively what they're doing is putting consenting adults together. And I don't know anybody who bought a house near the Peak who thinks that their real estate agent was immoral and so forth. I'm sure there are some who feel that. And really, you go down the chain to mortgage brokers and even Wall Street, and Wall Street was completely out of control, as evidenced by the fact that these firms all blew themselves up and half of them now don't even exist anymore. But I think a lot of the individuals in the firms thought they were behaving rationally and probably did not believe they were behaving immorally. Certainly some probably did. But so it starts to get very complicated. But to your point, the regulation is incredibly important for controlling the free market. There's just no question about that. That has been proven in spades over the last 5 years.
And coupled with that, the idea that people really can't be trusted to act in their own best interests. I mean, people... I can't remember the study right now, but I've heard that people, most of us, think we will be rich one day, and statistically, that can't come near close to the truth.
We are generally optimists, which is very good for our economy, but we do tend to overestimate our own chances and skills and so forth. But yes, people will definitely act in their own interest. It's getting them to act in other people's interests at the same time. That's obviously important.
Well, thank you to Mike for his call, and we take one now from Linda in Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, good morning, Mr. Blodgett. Now, I think a lot of people are greedy. They like to think they can get to the Forbes 400 list, but their problem is they don't know how to keep a good set of books. Now, they run their life just like a Ponzi scheme like Bernard Madoff did, and after a while it catches up with them. Now, the very people that believe in free enterprise, they go begging to the government to bail them out, and even to communist China, which really makes you wonder about free enterprise. And I do agree with the guest about Mr. Greenspan. And please comment.
Okay, thank you, Linda.
Thanks, Linda. I think that's I think that's true, again, that it's the, going back to Greenspan, I can certainly understand why he behaved the way that he did. And really, you go back to 2004, what Alan Greenspan was primarily worried about was that the collapse of the tech and stock market bubble would take the nation's economy down, and he was worried about deflation. And so he kept interest rates at 1% for a very long time, a lot longer than some experts thought he should have. And he has now been resoundingly deemed one of the primary villains in the housing bubble, because that made it possible for everyone to get these mortgages that, in hindsight, they shouldn't have been taking out. They were very cheap in the early years and then came back to kill people. But it is, again, I at least understand where Alan Greenspan was coming from. He was saying, look, I want to make sure that calamity A doesn't befall the country. And by the way, what you're asking me to do is stop this miraculous thing that is allowing so many people to buy houses who wouldn't ordinarily be able to buy houses, in which every single political constituency is saying, this is great, my constituents are building houses and they're getting rich, and they're selling houses and they're getting rich, and they're remodeling houses and they're getting rich. Alec Greenspan would have had to have a tremendously thick backbone to stand up and say, I am going to put an end to this because I believe that this is all going to come crashing down. And I'm sure that Greenspan was looking to some experts who were saying, look, it's different this time. These are not stocks. These are houses. We have this great population in the country, and we have people coming into the country to buy new houses. This is actually based in real fundamentals. It's not just a hallucination, so it's real. So with those inputs, I think it's easy to understand where Alan Greenspan was coming from, even though I do think he made a disastrous mistake.
Why do we always think it's going to be different this time? I mean, aren't there people in the industry who have that sort of professional memory that should carry them back? Historians, financial historians who are also analysts.
Well, financial historians are generally not employed in a lot of these businesses. And in fact, a lot of the businesses really are young, ambitious people who are very good at what they do, which is either selling houses or packaging up mortgages or selling mortgages or what have you. And a lot of them tend to be young. There is a reason that there is usually 30 to 50 years between bubbles like this. And it's because when they crash, as we are now going through, the memory of that is so searing to an entire generation of investors that you don't have the conditions necessary for people to be able to tell themselves that it's different this time. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I got into the business of Wall Street, I used to ask people about 1929, even the gray hairs when I got into it, either were not born or were tiny little children when that happened, and everything seemed like it had changed. We'd had 50 years where pretty much all the market did was go up. It just seemed like that was a crazy era where people weren't as sophisticated as they are now. And then you have what I alluded to earlier, which is that every year, year after year, prices continue to go up. And so unless you have a tremendous context in which to place every statement that is made about whether it's different this time or and why it's different this time, it's just very easy to come to the conclusion over time that it must be different, or this couldn't be happening, because this many people can't be stupid and can't be missing anything. And so year after year, the proof is in the prices, and eventually it just begins to persuade almost everyone that things must be different. And then one last complicating factor, and then I'll drop that topic, is that sometimes it is different. Certain things do change over time, certain financial relationships and so forth, and that occasionally will kill experts who do have the historical context to be able to be very confident that things are not different this time. And you'll get back and you'll find out that something changed, we went off the gold standard, or something that throws all these relationships out of whack. And so it's one more factor that even people who are really trying to sit back and get the answer right have to take into account, which is that it might actually be different this time.
Well, just as a funny historical aside from your article, I liked the part where people thought it would be different during Prohibition because people would be so much more sensible and hardworking.
Well, that's right. They're sober now. And
right.
that was not a silly person who was making that argument. That was Irving Fisher of Yale, who unfortunately also announced early, I think in October or September of 1929, that stocks had, quote, reached a permanently high plateau. But he was one of the most respected economists of the day and not given to making idiotic statements. And he obviously believed that, that we have a sober workforce now, so we'll be able to be that much more productive, and stocks are worth that much more.
Another call here from Marty in Milwaukee. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to mention that I did read the article in The Atlantic. I loved it. It's very, very effective in laying out the how this could have happened and how it's likely to happen again. But I do want to take a small issue with what your guest just said a moment ago, that our memory isn't long enough to allow for this to happen. And I go back to 1980 in the presidential campaign, and I remember, and that would have been within the living memory of folks who survived the Depression, who lived through the Depression. And I remember Ronald Reagan saying the 9 or 10 words in the English language where I'm here from the government and I'm here to help you, and how that got, you know, swept him into office because, by golly, we've had enough government regulation, we got to get them off our backs. And these are people who had lived, presumably voters who had lived through the Depression and knew what government assistance was about. And now 30 years later, asking for the government again, you know, now it's not so hard, it's not so bad to have the government come by and offer assistance, is it?
No, Marty. I mean, I think it's a very good point. I mean, I think that these trends toward regulation work in these huge cycles where you could go back to the 1970s and you could argue that the reason inflation was totally out of control and everything got so bad economically was that we had these price and wage controls and we were trying to stimulate the economy but making money too loose and so forth. And I think what Reagan said was, come on, government's going to get out of your face and let's see what that does for the economy. And it turned out it did a lot of very good things for the economy. And then Clinton came in, I think, with a little more a little more regulation. There was a good balance, and then we've gone through this period where we have not had anywhere near enough regulation. And so I think these cycles do work over time, and in large part, they are a reaction to the market and economy where we find ourselves.
Thank you for that call, Marty. And one more from Bob in Milton. Hi, Bob.
The first caller got about as close to it as I've heard so far, and I read Wall Street, Fortune Magazine, Condé Nast, everything, and none of them will broach that dreaded C word, raw mad dog capitalism, and it's on trial, and capitalism is the real enemy. Why don't the media and the lackey talking heads frame the greed game the way it really is? Capitalism is now in the dumpster, along with the paper economy, which has gone up the chimney in smoke. It's on trial for its life. Well, why is that? It's because it's a robber's roost operated by a den of thieves. We have blistering inflation. It's truly obscene. We have 14 recessions since World War II. We have 2,500% inflation in the last 60 years, leaving millions of people impoverished and downtrodden in its wake. Capitalism doesn't ever deliver freedom or peace or democracy, but rather tyranny and further chaos. Capitalism is the real culprit, and why don't you talk about it? It's the C word which is the problem.
Well, a lot there from Bob. He's obviously, you know, a strong statement that capitalism is on trial. What do you think, Henry Blodgett? I mean, Bob obviously has an extreme view of it, but do we need to be asking a bigger question here? Maybe that capitalism doesn't work for the average person.
I don't think so. With all due respect to Bob, that's a very strong statement, but these are very strong times, and it's certainly worth stepping back and asking that question. I mean, what I would go to is that overall, we have a pretty good economic system, and the general standard of living in this country is good. I think that has a lot to do with the success of the free market. Clearly, it needs to be tuned. In terms of the alternatives, I think it was Winston Churchill who said that democracy is the worst system on the planet, except for all of the others. I think you could say the same about capitalism. When I hear people trash capitalism, the question that comes to mind is, okay, so what's better? Is it going to be communism? And I think we've had now a lot of history that shows pretty conclusively that that doesn't work work either, at least as practiced, and in fact that it works worse than the system. But all that said, we have yet to get the balance consistently right about regulation in terms of using individual self-interest as the primary engine, but also keeping it in check. And it may just be, my suspicion is that it may just be very, very difficult, probably impossible, to get it so well tuned that you eliminate the business cycle. I don't think we will ever be able to do that. And I think as individuals participating in the economy and as companies trying to make forecasts and do their planning, I think that one of the mistakes that you consistently make is assuming that we will now be able to eliminate the business cycle and we can have this steady non-inflationary growth into the hereafter, and that is what has killed so many of our companies, with this assumption that the good times would keep on rolling, and suddenly we do have a major setback like this, and the companies have no choice but to run to Washington and beg for bailouts. And I think that in a lot of cases they have to look in the mirror and say, okay, we did not prepare for this, and we should have.
I know you have to go, but how bad do you think this is going to get? Have we seen the worst of it?
I don't think we've seen the worst of it in terms of job losses and in terms of the economy. The government is obviously acting very aggressively now, but most of the actions on the fiscal side in terms of government spending and so forth will take quite a while to kick in. And I think the major problem that we're going to have to overcome is getting out from under the incredible mountain of debt that we have built up, not only as consumers, but as a country. And if you look at the average of debt to GDP over time, we had a big peak in the 1920s and early 1930s, which then went back to normal, and then we've had an absolutely massive peak in the last 25 years. And I think we're going to have to work off a lot of that. I think that will take time. And my guess is that we will now go through a period that is every bit as much of a sobering change as the 1930s and 40s were after the Gilded Age of the 1920s, where everything got out of control, where you have a new sense of frugality, and that is admired instead of looked at curiously, and why would you ever save money when you can spend it? And I think we're going to get back to a lot of basic values, and that ultimately the country will emerge much stronger, and people will emerge much financially stronger from that. But I think it's going to be a very painful transition.
Well, I like the silver lining there. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Henry Blodgett is a former securities analyst and an editor at the Silicon Alley Insider, an online business publication. He's a contributor to Atlantic Monthly and the author of the article we're discussing today called Why Wall Street Always Blows It. Well, we'll be picking up with another guest in just a minute, John Carney, editor at the Silicon Alley Insider as well, talking further about this article and hopefully hearing from you about what lessons you're drawing from the recent financial meltdown and whether you think we can and should do something differently next time. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on today at 1 o'clock, join us for Talk of the Nation. Today, in hard times, there's a fallback. Just put it on the credit card, but not so much lately. Credit card companies are freezing credit limits, lowering credit limits, and after one on Talk of the Nation, your life in a recession, the credit card crunch, plus getting to the inauguration by any means necessary. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the financial meltdown right now with John Carney, an editor at the Silicon Alley Insider. And John Carney, thank you for being with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
If you don't mind, we're going to dive right back into the calls. We're, as you know, talking about the article, Why Wall Street Always Blows It, by your colleague Henry Blodgett. We were just talking with him.
I've been listening in. It's been fascinating.
Great. Well, let's go right to the phones. We've got a call from Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. The theme that I want to push for people to consider is that we live in a nation of denier liars, where people are unwilling to accept that what is, and that there should be consequences coming as a result of what is. And two examples of this quickly, in the Milwaukee Journal this Sunday, we had an article about how the EPA was denying people information about cancer-causing chemicals. And then in the Chicago Tribune, they were talking about this Madoff schedule of scandal of $50 billion being ripped off, and how the head of the SEC said he was concerned about multiple failures over a decade to investigate allegations of theft on the part of this guy. Well, you know, why wasn't the head of the SEC doing his job? And it just strikes me that on little things, or relatively little things, we deal with them. Like, for example, Spitzer gets consequences, and he should have, for his behavior. And Blagojevich will have consequences for accepting a bribe. But on the other hand, when an administration allows cancer-causing chemicals in the environment and allows $50 billion rip-offs without any consequences for the administrators that allowed this in the first place, you know, it just makes one wonder why some people get consequences in political life and others don't.
I think that's a really good point, actually. One of the things we have to think about is whether it's actually practical to expect government officials to be able to effectively help us avoid dangers such as cancer or getting ripped off by Bernie Madoff. I think we may have built up such an expectation that we'll be protected by the people we've appointed to, you know, keep us out of trouble, that we may actually not be taking enough care of ourselves in many ways. And so, in fact, what we've created is a moral hazard where we try to escape responsibility for our own lives or wish for an impossible level of safety that's really not practical. You know, we've seen time and time again, you know, we can go back, you know, beyond the things such as the Bernie Madoff scandal, to the bank failures, to even the, you know, the flood of New Orleans after Katrina, to say that, you know, the government really doesn't do a great job of protecting us, and I'm not sure there's a clear fix for that.
Well, it seems as though we want it both ways. We want the protection and the freedom.
That's right. One of the things we, and this goes back to the idea of trying to escape responsibility, I think there is something in a lot of us that says we want to be able to, you know, live our lives in a very open, free way on the one hand, and on the other hand, we expect that, you know, we can move into, you know, dangerous floodplains in the Midwest and be protected by the government. I think that a lot of this is going to be revisited over the next couple of years, where people start to say, you know, the guys we thought were protecting us, really, it's not just that they are corrupt or don't want to do their jobs, but the jobs we've assigned them in many ways may not be possible.
I want to ask you a question sort of dovetailing off of what Jim said that I've asked a lot of people, and I don't know if I've gotten quite the answer that would clear it up for me. But, you know, with the bailout of Wall Street, it seemed as though that was sort of a no-brainer, both for the country and for Congress. But in terms of the bailout of the big three, there was a lot more feet dragging. And it sort of seemed as though you could view it in terms of white-collar versus blue-collar. Obviously, there were a lot of white-collar executives in the auto industry as well. But what do you see as being the difference there? I know that people said the auto industry execs made very poor choices deliberately, but what is your take on that?
Right. I don't think it's a question of who made poor choices, because, believe me, the banking industry, if executives made poor, you know, choices just as poor, if not far, far worse. And we can see that just by the cost, the relative size of the different bailouts. It doesn't cost as much to bail out the auto industry as it does the banking industry. I think part of there is some truth to the idea that there was, if you're a senator, you probably can identify a little bit more with a guy who's the president of a bank. You know, you're both wear, you know, fancy suits to work and have people coming to, you know, sort of in a sycophantic way, speak to you every day. There's probably a little more identification there than there is with a guy who works on a factory line. On the other hand, in defense of the hesitancy of bailing out the audio industry, there is a perception that a car company or two could be allowed to collapse without creating a major financial catastrophe that could push us into the Great Depression, where we couldn't and this is arguable, but the lawmakers really believed we couldn't allow a bank like Citigroup to actually fail without putting the entire country into economic peril.
But with so much emphasis on needing to do things to rescue the middle class, what sort of typifies the working class, the middle class, more than the auto industry?
Well, I think that's been true for a long time. And I think one of the reasons people have been hesitant to bail out the auto industry is, in a sense, what we're doing is locking in the past practice by bailing out the auto industry. The middle class of America is going to have to find another way of remaining middle class. The auto industry, it's a bit like saying, and this drives people crazy when you make this analogy, but the horse and buggy industry also was allowed to fail. People, it may just be a economic activity that we are no longer going to engage in the United States.
Okay, another phone call now. We have Matt with us from Janesville. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I am actually from San Francisco, California. I'm visiting my parents right now and came across your show. Thanks for having it.
Thanks for listening.
And what I'm a builder, and what's very moving to me is looking at over the last 5 years what happened with the homes arena, and talking about Greenspan allowing the 1% rate to continue because America was enjoying such a fantastic run of being able to afford homes, which I feel is an absolute fallacy, because what I saw in my areas in California was that homes were inflating so much that while people could afford an adjustable rate mortgage to get themselves into it, their only hope for maintaining it was to get out of it in a couple of years where they could harvest a ton of equity money to offset the price of this inflation. So when we're looking at responsibility for what's happened in this, and that I make a decent salary to where I could have done the same thing, however, I wouldn't allow myself to because I knew that it wasn't sustainable. So when we're looking at who's responsible, I look at the American home buyer, and I'm irate with the idea of it being a financial crisis. It's a financial consequence for very, very poor decision-making on the part of America.
What about...
Sorry,
go ahead, John. No, you go ahead, John Kearney.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think there's a lot to that argument. I'm a renter myself. I also managed to skip out on the great housing boom of 2002 to 2007. But one of the things I think we have to remember is that the government really did encourage people, the government and the banks really did encourage people to buy houses and told them in various ways that it was almost a civic responsibility to become a homeowner. And so while people, you know, probably made unwise economic decisions for their personal lives, as a society, we definitely did our best to encourage them to make those kind of decisions.
We need to take another quick break right now, and then we'll be back to talk further with John Kearney, an editor at the Silicon Alley Insider. And we're hoping to hear from you this morning as well about what you've learned from the financial crisis, and maybe who do you think is responsible? Does the blame lie with us, or is it the government for not taking better care of us, or is there no blame to be assigned at all? Is it simply the risk of the cycle? The number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of great stuff still to come today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30, stay tuned for Chapter a Day as Jim Fleming reads The Cricket on the Hearth from Christmas Books by Charles Dickens. I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping you company this morning for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the recent financial meltdown right now with John Kearney, an editor at the Silicon Alley Insider. And I want to read an email we got in response to one of the calls. I think it was Bob who earlier said that capitalism was on trial. Well, Tom from River Falls was listening, and he wrote, "We're going through another cycle. This does not suggest the demise of capitalism and the free market. The current malaise is inconsequential compared to the Great Depression. The free market and capitalism built the greatest democracy and industrial economy the world has ever seen. The little blip is not the end of America. What do you think, John Carney?
I think that that's right. This isn't the end of America, but I'm cautious. It always makes me worried when people say this blip is not as bad as the Great Depression, because you have to remember that the Great Depression wasn't as bad as the Great Depression until it got that bad. Mm. Right after the 1929 crash, people could have said, well, you know, unemployment really isn't that high right now, and it wasn't. It took a few years for it to tick up to the 25% level that it got to. So we need to realize that the way we react to this crisis can really affect and may really be able to make it better or worse. And so we have to be very cautious about being a little too optimistic about what may happen to us as we go further into the crisis.
You know, when I was growing up, I remember being taught, I think it was even in school, that we were now depression-proof. What happened to that idea?
I think there was and Henry mentioned this earlier, there was an idea that we had somehow technocratically solved the problem of business cycles. And we clearly haven't solved the problem of business cycles. We've been through quite a few of them. And people thought, well, maybe if we haven't solved the crisis of business cycles, what we've solved is, you know, the crisis of really bad ones. The problem was, it's hard to establish a negative. In other words, when you think that you've avoided the idea that you can get in a Great Depression, you don't know that because you're not sure whether or not you've faced a situation that might put you into one. It's a bit like when people say, well, you know, we haven't suffered a major terrorist attack since 2001. We're not sure right now how many may have been avoided or whether we've just been lucky enough not to have one yet.
Another call now. We've got Patty with us from Eau Claire. Hey, Patty.
Yes, good morning. I feel like this time is rather bittersweet. Part of me is excited about this because I believe in social Darwinism. And, you know, when I heard the last gentleman that you had on say, you know, people in the business world thought it would always stay good. Well, such foolishness. Nothing stays good all the time in any individual life. Why would anybody think everything is always going to stay good? I mean, people have lost, and I think particularly powerful, wealthy people lost track. They got themselves in some kind of tunnel vision, thinking that they've hit utopia. And so part of me is excited that the things that don't work are going to fail, and we should let them fail, and that out of the pain, like in any individual life, you're going to mature. And hopefully the United States will stop being the teenager of the world and maybe come out of this being more like an adult in the world. And other point is that we need to take a look at what is the role of government on a fundamental level. And this argument's gone on since the Constitutional Congress. I mean, should the government be there as a safety net for people that need it or not, or stay out of things? And I personally believe they should be there as a social, we should pay into it enough to have a social safety net for those who need it. So the auto companies can fail, but the out-of-work workers would get, retraining or increased unemployment and that kind of thing. And personally, what I've done is I've moved to a city. I've moved to a smaller home. I'm going to learn how to grow a garden, and I'm going to put in a wood pellet stove. So thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Patty.
I think that's actually, there's a lot to be learned from what she said. And actually, one of the great dangers we're facing right now is by not letting companies fail. We eliminate what she described as the Darwinism of the market, where the markets don't really work if failed enterprises aren't allowed to fail. A woman named Anna Schwartz, who helped write the book that described to everyone what really went on in the Great Depression, did an amazing interview with the Wall Street Journal recently in which she said, we're doing things wrong by propping up failed banking institutions, and she warned that we may actually be getting ourselves in worse trouble by taking out that level of market discipline. And there are other ways as the caller said, you know, maybe what we should be doing is thinking about what we should be doing with auto workers right now to make sure that their lives don't turn miserable when the companies fail without propping up failed businesses.
So you see that as, the market Darwinism that she's talking about there.
I think it's
a little. How do you see that as being something that would necessarily lead to a stronger, better government or a stronger, better financial system?
Well, in many ways, it would be a great thing if when a banking official was making decisions, if they know that, you know, hey, if this program that I'm launching, if this new mortgage security that I'm issuing out to the public ends up blowing up, that, you know, I'll get bailed out by the government, that creates a really perverse incentive because then they'll take risks that they would never take if they knew, hey, if I do this, my company will fail. There's a risk that I'll be out of a job. Right now, we haven't reinforced that kind of market discipline on them. So they're willing to take risks that they would never take. And that is exactly how we got into this position. And we may be setting ourselves up for yet another round of inordinate risk-taking followed by, and I hope this never happens, but followed by yet another round of bailouts sometime down the road.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if that same philosophy would also result in more shady business practices.
Well, there is a danger that people, if they didn't think that they could, appeal to the government for assistance, would then try to cover up their actual failure. I guess that's what you're getting at.
Right.
That's a danger, but I'm not sure that that you can cover up very successfully your failure for very long. I mean, you know, the people at Enron, you know, tried their hardest and they weren't able to. In the end, the truth will out, and the market's actually very good if it's allowed to operate at uncovering fraud and abuse.
Okay, another call now. Dave with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I took issue with something that said earlier in the program. I'm thinking about this penal article that have come out in the Milwaukee Journal, and governments of the past, we used to have a strong EPA, and they used to protect us by having scientists that would discover things like this, and we'd elect people and pass legislation to protect ourselves. The last 8 years, though, the Bush administration hasn't liked science, and businesses have complained that the regulation's been too much, and so they've glossed over and produced all these this cancer-causing chemical and all this plastic all over the place. And so I think, you know, we elect the government to serve us, and I think they should protect us to some degree. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Dave. John Carney?
I think there is a good point made there that we do have a right when we to expect the government to do the jobs we've assigned them. But we also have to wonder, and particularly if there are egregious abuses or people ignoring dangers that were brought up, we may want to consider whether or not that those people should be held responsible. Certainly, if anybody has ignored, you know, a serious danger that was brought to them, you know, a cancer-causing chemical that they just decided to sweep under the rug, at the very least, they should lose their jobs, and perhaps they should be prosecuted. But the other danger, again, as I said, is expecting too much. Remember that government officials at all levels at all times are just people, and they respond to the same kind of incentives that all other people do. And so we're never going to get a kind of a platonic class of guardians who will, you know, sit over us disinterestedly and guide us with their wisdom. It's just unavailable.
Another call now from Jake in Oshkosh. Hi, Jake.
Hello.
Hi.
That was actually very close to my point. I just wanted to mention that, you know, when we talk about the government should do this or the government should do that and all that, the government is just people, you know, and when it comes to blaming people, it really can be spread across all facets of it, whether they happen to work in government or not work in government. And if anything really needs to change, it should start at the ground level with people that work in government. And if money is influencing why you work in government, your intentions are wrong from the start. And I just wanted to know what you thought about that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jake. John Carney?
I think that that's very right. But mostly the problem really isn't that people in government want a lot of money. A lot of them have actually given up, a much higher income than they could have earned in private industry in order to work in government. But that's not because they're, better people than the rest of us who, you know, work to maximize our income. A lot of times it's because either they crave the kind of power and prestige that goes with the office of being in government. Other times it's because it's just an easier job when you don't have to make a profit. Again, we're all motivated by normal human desires. We're never going to get the perfect government that will watch over us. And so we're really charged, everybody, with watching over ourselves, our friends, and our family.
Well, John Carney, it's been a great morning, and I thank you for your time. I wish we had more of it.
I wish I could talk for a long time. This has been great. Your audience is terrific.
I know it. Well, thank you so much, and have a great holiday.
Thank you, Veronica. You too.
Bye-bye. John Carney is an editor at the Silicon Alley Insider. And we've been talking about his colleague's article, Henry Blodgett's article, called Why Wall Street Always Blows It. I want to thank Brittany DeAnda for on-air production this morning, and Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing the program. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program 1223D. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.